We have a great class today. We're doing the teenage brain today. Yay! It's really fun. You're gonna be excited about it. But I heard that some people got to see Arianna Huffington and talk about mindfulness. Has everyone heard about it? How many people haven't heard about it? Okay. All right. Anthony, do you want to tell everyone just a little bit about what she said and what she invited you guys to do and what you said to her about the program?
Well, she talked a lot about, so she has this new book. It's called Thrive. And in the book, she talks a lot about meditation and how meditation can help you live like a balanced lifestyle. So I asked her about that, and I asked her, about how her work ethic leads her to think like that. And then Prima, she mentioned that we do it in school. So then she was more interested to find out, a little bit more about our program. So then she told Mrs. Baskin that she wants us to kind of get a few quotes, write an article, and convince her to part of the conference.
Excellent.
You're not listening, but I told you.
So it's, all right.
That's what's important, because I need you after.
So just to... I've met Arianna Huffington a few times, so this is really great. What it means, though, for everyone here is that the program that you're doing right now and your engagement with this is going to be mentioned on Huffington Post, which means a lot of people are going to notice it. And that's a pretty great thing, since there are a lot of school mindfulness programs. This one is... not just technique. You're learning a lot of context and perspective, which is different than what's being taught. So it's really a chance to showcase the IB program here, what you're doing, your insight on it, and I think it'd be great if some students want to be interviewed too, so you quote a few people. So I would recommend that a couple people who might want to get their quotes in the Huffington Post see if Anthony will be willing to interview you. Yeah. Great. All right. So let's start with...
Not really.
It doesn't matter at all.
It really doesn't.
Okay. So we'll sit for about five minutes, maybe a little longer, and we'll just focus on the breath. Pay attention to your posture. And let yourself experience the immediacy of the breath, how the breath is there regardless of the distraction of your mind, making the effort to focus on the breath is the whole purpose of this type of meditation. You'll still have thoughts. You'll still be distracted. But we're exercising a type of concentration that will retrain the brain. And it'll retrain us. If you hear noise, just notice that there's noise. You can label it noise and return to the breath. Let go of any storyline around the distractions and focus on the immediacy of the breath.
Here.
We can put one more chair. We can put one more right up there. Yeah. Okay. Hi. All right. Any questions? How'd it go?
It's the same every week for me. Like, whenever we do these representations, I know what I'm supposed to be focusing on, so I know what things to look for. So when I know to, like, take note of my nostrils, like, flaring up just a tiny bit, I know to take note that I feel the cool air going in and warm air coming out, and I know to take note that, like, in the back of my throat, there's, like, a somewhere going on. So, like, every week, and, like, when I try to do it, when I can't go to sleep, I do the breath meditation. It's easy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, it's a little method where I go through my mental checklist. I'm like, all right, so I can feel my nose doing that, and I can feel the breath going in. And so this is how I know it's supposed to be working. But I don't know if that's too much thinking involved with breathing. Even though we're supposed to be focusing on breathing?
I think that's fine.
Yeah.
You don't want to create the sensations in your mind first. You want to find the sensations in your body.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to be with what you're experiencing before you say, oh, I should be feeling my lungs rising and falling. Mm-hmm. Where is that? So you want to do it the other way. Because what it does, that's really going to it's going to shift the way we're working with our minds. It's going to shift it so that we're really working with the immediacy of what we're actually experiencing rather than our thoughts about it. And that's very important because we have a lot of thoughts about things that aren't necessarily accurate. And we project them onto reality.
Mm-hmm.
This person hates me. You have that idea. Everything they do, whether they tie their shoe or... they drink a glass of water, becomes a verification of what you're projecting on them. So we want to be with the immediacy of the experience first,
mm-hmm.
not the ideas about them and then looking for them. Other questions?
I'm better, I think I've become more agile at being able to focus. So
uh-huh.
I missed a few sessions.
Yeah.
Coming back, I realized I'm better able to focus. More quicker. For a longer period of time, that instead of, you know, just knowing that I'm supposed to focus and
yeah.
letting other things get in the way, like the thoughts,
right.
it's more immediate.
Yeah. Great. How'd it go for you?
I was confused.
You're confused about instructions or about what your experience was?
I don't know. I was trying to figure out what I was supposed to be hearing. And then there weren't any thoughts, but I need something to grab onto so that I don't think. So I was listening to that radiator, and I tried to listen to the breaths, but I don't hear anything.
Mm-hmm.
So
you didn't have any particular thoughts. You were just quiet and still. So if you're just quiet and still, you don't need to create a thought.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to look for. Did you feel like you needed to look for something?
In order to not think anything, I need to, focus on something.
Uh-huh.
So I was looking for sounds that were consistent, and that was what I was doing.
Mm-hmm. That's okay. I mean, can you feel the breath in your nose, or can you feel your stomach rising and falling?
Yeah, but it's not enough to keep me from not thinking.
Uh-huh.
I need something louder.
Okay. That's fine. I mean, you can... We're not trying to stop thinking. So if we're trying to stop thinking, we're all going to fail. If we're trying to stop thinking, we're not going to get rid of our thoughts. But if we are able to choose what we're going to pay attention to and say, oh, yeah, thought, it's just, it's a mechanical function and the brain is churning it out and it's wanting me to pay attention to it. I don't really want to pay attention to it now. I want to pay attention to the rise and fall of my abdomen.
Yeah,
well, it's hard. I mean, monks go off and into the forest for 10 or 15 years to figure out how to do this. So, because it's hard, the effort to cultivate this kind of awareness is good. And that effort is, it's like exercise. It doesn't mean you're going to be an Olympic athlete at the beginning, but that effort's still good. And you can choose a sound if you want, a sound in the room. But don't have a storyline about it. So if it's people walking the hall and you're paying attention to people walking the hall and then you're wondering what they're doing there and who is it and do you recognize the voice, that's what you don't want to do.
That's what I was doing.
Yeah. Right. Anything else? Creative name tags. It's my test to find them. Any other questions? Okay. So, teenage brain. So, part of what this whole exercise of learning mindfulness is to learn how to navigate adolescence and the changes in adolescence with more clarity. There's certain things you're not going to be able to avoid. They're evolutionary responses that have been developed over 400 million years. You're not going to overcome that because you think you should. So what you want to do is start to develop clarity around what's happening. One of the things that we learned last week was about the different parts of the brain. Does anyone remember?
The reptilian core.
The reptilian brain, and what does that do?
That's the fight, flight, or freeze.
Excellent. What else?
Memories.
There's also certain kind of brain. There's actual a brain around our gut and a brain around our heart. It's not just a poetic. And that's great. And then there's an emotional center, right? The limbic center. There are actually two parts of limbic center, but we only have one thumb to show them. And the limbic center is the emotional center. It helps. It basically also developed 300 million years ago. And it's the second part of the brain to develop when we're in utero. And that helps us. It's an emotional center. And then what's the whole rest of the brain? And what does it do? Blaine, do you remember?
We have like the frontal part.
There's the cortex and then the prefrontal cortex. Do you remember what it does? The prefrontal, the cortex is what basically deals with relationships, and the prefrontal cortex is what integrates. Now, what happens, first of all, adolescence and puberty are two different things. They don't actually track the same time span. Adolescence really goes from the time of mostly 15 until 22. Some parts of the brain develop between when you're 15 and 30. So when you're talking about brain development, you're not talking about just the high school years. You're talking about a period of development where the human organism is going from being dependent on our parents to independent. And it's an evolutionary function. The orangutans are the other primate that takes a very long time to develop. They are dependent on their mothers for the first 8 years, completely dependent. And in fact, an orangutan female can only conceive once every 8 years because it takes so much to nurture the little baby orangutan until they grow up and are able to eat on their own and things like that. So the human animal is very interesting, and we take a very long time to develop. We're very dependent on our parents. And this period of adolescence and the adolescent brain function is a very important part of brain development, and it's when the brain is physiologically changing so that we can go from being dependent to being on our own. So this is all things that they've only learned relatively recently. And a lot of ideas that everyone had about teens and teen rebellion and peer pressure and risk-taking and kind of lack of good judgment, which they never understood physiologically before, now they recognize, oh, there's actually a period. It's really important that this period happens. You cannot go from the 8-year-old brain to the 35-year-old brain. What's happening physiologically is you're actually trimming synapses. You're losing parts of your brain. So it's like pruning a tree. You're cleaning up. And it's a pretty radical pruning that's happening in the brain. And then the other thing that's happening is that the synapses are like, they're like little, you know, you've seen pictures of them probably. They look like little veins running through. They're little pipelines. They all have a coating. That coating develops and strengthens during adolescence. So during this period between 15 and 22 or 15 and 30, you're myelinating the synapses. And what myelin does is it helps integrate and it helps for clarity and discernment. Without that, you actually can't discern very clearly. You don't feel as much. You don't have as complex emotions, and you aren't able to synthesize as well. So there's some interesting things that are happening. Now, what we want to learn about is we also want to learn about, well, what does that mean about our functioning? Because we have brain development happening. We also have hormonal development happening in adolescence. So there are raging hormones going on in adolescence, which cause us to feel certain things, get excited about certain things, giggle about certain things. The brain function and the hormonal function are both kind of exploding right now in different ways. And you can't really control both of them, but you can understand about them. And it's really pretty cool how it works, which I want to get all the... So what's one of the key complaints about adolescence? Or like, let's list the top five.
We're immature.
Immature. That's a good one. What else? Stupid.
Lack of hygiene.
Lack of hygiene. That's fine. That's... What else? Annoying.
We're dangerous.
Dangerous. Why?
Bad judgments.
Bad judgment. Reckless. What else?
Emotional.
Moody. These are really good. What else? What was that? What you? Who said what? Okay. Whatever it was probably good.
I guess branching from that, sexually active.
Or curious. What else?
Oh, you're just horrible. You know that, right?
These are all good. Yeah. Did you have one?
Oh, me?
Yeah.
I guess impulsive.
Impulsive. Very good. So how many of you think that that's because you're not paying attention, or do you sort of feel like you have no choice about some of those things? Who feels like it's because they're not paying attention, or they're defiant and belligerent and rebellious? How many people feel that? And how many people feel you have no control over it to some degree or another? And how many don't want to admit? Okay. So, both are true. And we'll figure out why. Because once you can understand what's happening in the brain and why it's happening, you can still become responsible about your behaviors. Because a lot of teen injury, teen fatalities do come from not understanding this well enough. So it's an important thing that you do need to pay attention to and be responsible for.
Ms. Smith, please contact the main office. Ms. Smith, please call the main office. Thank you.
So it's important to do the things your parents tell you and listen to them and be safe and careful and cautious. But there are reasons why you're inclined not to. And there are reasons why you do things that panic the adults around you, and for good reason. So what's happening in the brain is that our circuitry changes. There's a certain circuitry that's going on up until we're about 15. Now, one thing that happens is dopamine, which makes us happy, drops. There's a base level of this, I don't know what it is. Is it a hormone? There's a base level of this hormone that drops in adolescence. Now, we need to have that level up. Now, what creates dopamine is risk, excitement, thrill, adventure. So your dopamine levels have dropped. In order to get them back up, you seek risky, exciting situations. And now it's a physiological function. Why? Because evolution has designed the human brain to do this. So you seek out these new experiences in order to learn things so you can then live on your own, not under the care of your parent. It's far out. So over 400 million years, well, humanoids are a lot less time, but the brain has been developing for 400 million years. But, you know, we've been developing for, you know, in this kind of way, sort of the last 100,000 years of culture. But in order to raise your levels, you seek risky situations. That increases the amount of dopamine that's coursing through your system, and your body feels, oh, that's fine, I'm in good shape. But that does cause you to do things that you shouldn't be doing. So that's one aspect of it. And then the other aspect is that there's a function in the brain which is called hyper-rational thinking. And by hyper-rational, it means it's not that part of the mind that tells you, I'm looking for this and I want to find that, and I'm looking for this and I want to find that. That's the rational mind which we understand. The hyper-rational mind is commanding us to do things, and it has a scale. Now, the way the hyper-rational mind works in the 8-year-old brain and the adult brain are more similar than the adult brain and the adolescent brain. Now, what happens when you're younger is you just have a lot of stimulus and you're just learning a lot, and you don't have a lot of discrimination and not a lot of subtlety. But you're not seeking for anything particular. There's so much incoming. When you're an adult, you're not seeking for anything in particular because the brain has been developed. You're not trying to compensate for all of that. When you're an adolescent, basically what's happened is that this hyper-rational part of the brain is reprogrammed in adolescence to bias risk-taking behavior. So that which is exciting, that which is thrilling, that which is new, that which is innovative, that which is creative, the hyper-rational brain in adolescence is looking for that. So it has good and bad sides. Part of what's good about it is that it's very creative. It's a very, very creative time. Adolescence between the ages of, what I mean, this extended period between the ages of 15, 22, 15, and 30 is an incredibly creative time. So you'll start looking for new solutions. You'll start to question the status quo. You'll start to realize that things could be done differently. You'll see ways that things can be done. You can see that a lot of ideas about the environment are coming from, you know, even under 30 solutions. That's all part of this bias towards the new. And that's something that can be cultivated in adulthood, and people who don't cultivate that tend to lead, you know, relatively boring lives. So how does that sound? What did it explain to you? You said it explained a lot, right? No. Wayne.
I see how, like, a lot of, like, high school kids behave now. It makes a lot more sense why they're doing certain things. Even though it's not, like, rational, sometimes they can't help it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they're just seeking new things to do because they're bored.
Right. Intellect and emotional intelligence are two different things. So you can be the, I mean, you probably know people like this. I'm sure none of them are in this class, but really smart people who do really stupid things, but they're really, really bright.
You mean this entire
class? No, I'm sure nobody's in here. Nobody like that's in here, but you must know somebody like that. So what else made sense to you?
Oh, I'm very impulsive and like to do this. Things, except that I don't really have any parents to rebel against.
Why? Because they let you do it. They're
they're very like free range type. They're kind of like, well, we're here if you want advice, but other than that, do your own thing.
So that's an that's an interesting situation. It's not always that helpful. Structure's helpful. My parents were like that, but I wouldn't, if I had a daughter, I would never let her do what I did, because when I was 20 years old, I went for 12 months into the Himalayas on my own. So, it wasn't particularly safe.
My parents just decided recently that they might like to become normal parents, and but I'm like 18 now, and they're like, well, maybe you can do that, and I'm not asking you for permission. I'm telling you what I'm
doing. So now that you understand all this,
that's the answer.
What'd she say? Well, the thing is, now that you understand this, so the thing about, there's another aspect of this which I'll explain about, but the fact that the teenage brain biases risk-taking behavior means also what in the teenage brain, it doesn't process consequences. It doesn't process moral consequences. And that's a problem because there's so much biological pressure, physiological pressure towards risk, and there isn't that integrative function, the prefrontal cortex, which integrates a moral function on top of it. So If that moral function was fully integrated, then you could be more trustworthy, or your decisions, it's not just you, it's your decisions would be more reliable. And that's where kind of a more creative dialogue about these things is important, because your impulses are not going to filter in information about safety, consequences, moral effects, effects on others, effects on your future. And there are, you know, you can start looking, there are a lot of scary stories about what happens, you know, and a lot of harm that happens. So parents trying to exert control way after they should have done it when you were 12 or 13 or 14, they might have something that would be useful in dialogue to say. In fact, they probably do. So, simply because the adult mind works differently and looks at situations differently and analyzes them differently. Yeah.
What is morality?
Morality is, it's our own, there's a social code, there's a societal code, there's a religious code, and there's a personal code of about what's right and what's wrong. Well, causing harm, you know, in violence, you know, violence between boys and girls, sexual violence, those things can be called wrong. They're harmful. And you can, it's a complicated question because in postmodernity, we've learned to see things from multiple perspectives. So the question of what's moral is not a code that was given to us by the church. But as human beings and as responsible human beings, we need to start developing a moral code. And then there's also a social moral code, and some things are illegal because they are also immoral. Killing, you know, raping, child abuse. These kinds of things are immoral. They're harmful, so we've deemed them that way, and then there's consequences. There are more subtle aspects. So you can have a moral code between your friends, which might be your accepted moral code, but it might not be the best moral code. Or it might be at a higher standard than the moral code of the culture around you. What do you think?
So on Easter, right? I went to my grandmom's house, and everyone is Christian. And my dad's big mouth decided to tell everyone I wasn't Christian. And they asked me, what is there right and wrong? And from a religious perspective, of course, they said, yes, there is. But I said, no, there isn't a such thing as right and wrong. And when you said that teenagers do things without thinking about the morality of it, like, let's say I broke the law before. I mean, I didn't do harm to anyone. So what made my act immoral, you know?
What kind of law did you break?
I didn't say I did.
Did you steal?
You
should give me.
But would that be immoral, or would it just be, quote unquote, wrong?
Well, it's illegal. I mean, our society has codes. Okay.
It's not just
moral, but its intent is moral. When you have, you know, this many billion people on a planet, you need laws and codes and boundaries, and they are roughly what's right and what's wrong. And a part of it is to create order. If we didn't have traffic lights, then no one would stop. I mean, nobody stops at them in Philadelphia anyway. But
that's really funny.
Now, the thing about, see, we need to be able to distinguish right and wrong. I mean, that is and it's a question that's complicated. So there are people who would say that you can't measure the difference or the morality, the moral fiber between Adolf Hitler and Nelson Mandela. I don't have a problem saying that Adolf Hitler did amoral, you know, immoral things and had nowhere near the stature of a human being like Nelson Mandela. I have no problem doing that. There are a lot of people who do, but that's a total breakdown of our understanding of morality in postmodernity. So if you tell your Christian family that there's no right and wrong, you're saying, I don't subscribe to the code of morality as it's laid out in the Bible the way you do. But are you saying that there's no right and wrong?
I'm saying it's not that black and white. And that's really hard for me to say because I believe everything is black and white, but I don't think that's black and white.
Right.
I don't think there's such a thing as right and wrong.
Hey, there we go. So if your friend says, I'm going to back you up no matter what, and you do something horrible to somebody else, you know, you would be.
Depending on what you say.
Well, they're both.
What am I in the face room?
Yeah.
You kill somebody. I mean, I'm going to college next year.
So, good questions. Good questions. So, I want to talk a little bit about what makes right and wrong for the teenage brain, because part of the other thing about being a teen is when we talked about this, the generalizations, peer pressure. Right? How many feel peer pressure? Either you resist it or you ignore it or you succumb to it, but how many experience peer pressure in one way or another? Some people don't identify as experiencing it. It is another physiological function in the brain at this age. Why? Because you need to, part of the teenage years is developing relationships. Like, when we're a child, we're related to our parents, they take care of us. From an evolutionary perspective, they take care of us, we're the offspring, we're young. We need protection from the wild animals and the other tribes people. When we become adults, we need to have our own social network. It's deeply programmed in us. So the adolescent years are the years when the part of the brain that forms relationships and learns how to form relationships is very active. It's developing, it's growing, it's learning, and forming relationships, learning how to form relationships and maintain them is how, as an adolescent, you can separate yourself and become an adult. Now, don't think about this in terms of yourself just personally. Just think about it more in evolutionary terms. You can see, oh, there are these little things. They get bigger. They're not fully independent. They need each other. And then the parents get too old to take care of them. And then this social group has grown up and can act as the adults. So peer pressure is a huge function at this time. So a lot of the examples are, you know, like, you feel like if you don't go to a certain party or have a certain, you know, you don't get invited, or you're not in the play, or you don't have the right shoes, it becomes a very charged issue. The reason why is because this need to belong or differentiate from the group is what's happening in the brain. It's good. It's all part of development, creative process. It's bad when there's peer pressure without that kind of discriminating judgment, and then you throw in alcohol, driving, drugs, and disasters happen. It's not just because of bad judgment. It's not just because of weak-mindedness. You're also driven that way. So because you're driven that way, you need to exercise certain cautions and build cautions into what you do. So all these behaviors are not just rebellion. They're all part of this process. There's a positive side to them. But you can start thinking about your experience in these broad evolutionary terms and start looking for, oh, I'm learning this. I don't know how to do that. When I'm 30, I should be able to be doing that better and differently. How's that sound?
Very interesting.
Interesting, right? What do you think? The quiet side. Questions? Does it make sense? Yeah. Does the peer pressure make sense? Yeah. And the need to form peer groups, it's not just groups. I mean, you may have one friend, you may have, you know, it's just that that focus on how we're seen and how we're interacting with each other, it's part of the physiology. So where mindfulness can help, we're developing the integrative function. We're developing objectivity. So when you get quiet and you can't quiet your mind and you start seeing all these thoughts, you're going to know what's in there. You're going to know what you want to do, where you want to rebel, who you like, what your creative ideas are. You're going to know what's going on. Or if you feel really bad about something that's not that objective, you just know that. You're not going to change your feeling. You can't. There's no off switch. Cool. So I think we have, is it now?
20 minutes. Do we 50 or 53? 53.
53. Okay.
What time is it?
50.
Is the clock slow? That's why I'm always off with this one. So, any questions? We'll do like a minute of meditation. I wanted to leave a few minutes, but I... Any other questions?
I can send them a couple minutes late. It's okay.
I mean, the bell's going to shut. The
bell's going to ring, but they'll just...
But let's sit for a few minutes, because it's a lot to take in. And it's always no excuse, right? We all have to do the right thing. All right. Let's sit for a few minutes. And when you sit, just let it all go. Don't try to assimilate it all right now. So see if you can let go of everything you just learned. It'll come back to you. Thanks very much. Have a good week.